Welcome to the podcast, Agia Goes Viral. We here at the Arab-German Young Academy of Sciences and Humanities, Agia for short, invite you to join us as we explore the diverse implications of COVID-19 for science and society at large. In each episode, Arab and German Agia members and alumni from different scientific disciplines come together to discuss research on and amidst the coronavirus pandemic. In today's podcast episode, Agia member Dr. Louisa Fischer from Germany and Agia alumnus Professor Ahmed Al-Gindi from Egypt share their thoughts on a possible second wave of COVID-19 and the role of scholars and society in times of crisis. Louisa Fischer is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Fraunhofer Center for International Management and Knowledge Economy in Leipzig. Ahmed Al-Gindi is professor of mathematics at Cairo University.
Good morning, Louisa. Very pleased to get a chance to chat with you. Please tell me, how are things going on in Leipzig?
Good morning, Ahmed, from my side as well. Likewise, I'm very much looking forward to our short conversation today. So you asked me about the situation in Leipzig, which is, for those who don't know, about 160 kilometers southwest of Berlin. It's a nice city with about 600,000 inhabitants, and the situation with COVID-19 is actually not too bad. So yes, people, we have to wear masks in public, in shops, in all places where we are like in a closed situation that's not private. And we are keeping a distance of a meter and a half where we can. Of course, we're not supposed to have large gatherings of larger groups, and traveling is very limited. But other than that, life is almost back to normal, I would say. So how's the situation with you? How's Cairo?
So Cairo, nowadays it's summertime, of course, and fortunately with the COVID-19, we seem to have passed the peak, at least the first peak, that was maybe back in June. So July and August have been relatively a fewer number of cases. The number of cases went down. But then it keeps going up and down again. And I think the good thing is that people are aware that there is this concept of a possible second peak. And so, people are trying to avoid that it happens in a way that's higher than the first one or as bad as it was. So hopefully that works. Otherwise, in fact, the weather is not too bad. I mean, Egypt can be hot in the summer, and it is hot, of course, but it's not too hot, I think, this year. I don't know if that's because not many people are going out, so there is a bit of like environmental positive effects, or is it just a coincidence? I really don't know.
That sounds good. It's actually similar here. People are speaking of a second wave coming or already present, and everybody's trying to avoid that or to avoid the same consequences as during the first wave. So I'm very happy to hear that the situation is sort of bearable for most of us. It's
yes,
good.
We're fortunate in that way, and I think that maybe this understanding of the possibility of a second wave gives an example of what we want to talk about how science and knowledge and research can inform us and improve our lives, giving us more examples of that. Because if we didn't know the historical scenarios in which different diseases came, and then people thought that they went, and then they didn't take precautions, and then a second wave that was bigger than the first one ended up coming and having more devastation. That I think that it's a good thing that we learned from these lessons, and hopefully we continue to learn from them and continue to improve the situation.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the topic we are looking at today, so what can especially science and education do in order to, let's say, improve crisis situations, or maybe even to increase the resilience of a society. And by resilience, we really mean the ability of a society to recover from shocks like this, to recover from periods of intense difficulty, of challenge. What do you think, Ahmed? What is the greatest, or what do you think is one of the key learnings for science, let's say, first, and education from this very current crisis?
Well, I think scientists themselves in a way, you know, the scientist is a person usually who spends a lot of time focusing on specific areas that maybe to the layman they don't seem very relevant. But then when something like this happens, all of a sudden people become very interested in things that before they weren't interested in. Maybe let me give you a couple of examples. So I'm a mathematician, and we have this concept of how things can grow exponentially. You know, when this crisis came, a lot it became a mainstream concept because people were very interested in how one infected person can affect a number of people around them. And then you know, we start speaking about the details of how if instead of a person affects maybe 2.5, it's a lot worse than if it affects 1.6, even though the numbers by themselves, they don't look that much of a difference between them. But if you look at and when they start multiplying in large societies, then this happens. So on one level, it's been a good thing for scientists to, you know, realize, reaffirm the usefulness of this idea of let us understand concepts deeply so that when the crisis comes, we have enough knowledge to combat it rather than wait for the crisis to come and then start scrambling around for the tools. Similar things happened with, let's say, biological concepts. People started to become interested in what is a virus. What does it mean for the virus to have a mutation? Does the mutation make it stronger or weaker? Sometimes it makes it stronger, sometimes it's weaker. How can we affect that? What are the steps of finding a vaccine? So all of these things became topics of great relevance to laymen, to policymakers, and to different fields of scientists. And I'm hopeful that if we learn the right lessons from this, then we will emerge as a whole, actually, planet in a better place in terms of respect for science and resources that are given to it, in terms of school children being more interested in going into this field and having better effect on the society. What is your take? What is your take on the resilience of society being informed by its knowledge?
I absolutely agree with what you just said, and I'd like to just elaborate on, or maybe to give two more points on this very issue. And I'll start with the last point you actually spoke about. And you mentioned the importance of science, biology, mathematics in this case, in informing politicians or in informing policymakers, which we've seen is essential in order to avoid fake news or, let's say, wrong information, spreading maybe panic or triggering, let's say, inhibiting policies or actions. So COVID has really shown the importance of, as you said, deep, intensive understanding of really complex matters and informing decision makers. At the same time, I'm a social scientist, so working strongly with society. COVID has shown in our work that in order to understand, but also actually to really approach complex problems, and COVID is it itself is a complex problem, but it is triggering other issues. So in order to trigger such complex problems, we see the importance of, at least in some cases, of not doing just science, but doing science with society and for society. So we speak about, let's say, participatory, or we also call it transdisciplinary, because it's going beyond the disciplines, beyond the academic disciplines, transdisciplinary research or work, which means to include the communities that are affected in our research, to actually do the research sometimes with the communities. So that starts with the framing of a research question, which should be based on the very need of that particular community if it's meant to tackle the issues by which the community is affected. So COVID is really showing us the importance of, as I said, not only involving and informing the community, but really to do the research when it's appropriate, of course, but when the community is affected, to do the research with that community from the very start and until maybe even the very end. So include the community also sometimes, if it's appropriate, in the decision-making process about the respective actions. That is one point. And then there's another point I wanted to ask you, Ahmed. What do you think about, you know, we've just mentioned working with stakeholders or with society as a whole, as scientists, but what do you think about working with other sciences? Do you see any particular learning as a mathematician and working interdisciplinarily, so with other academic disciplines that may be a little further away from you?
Yes, definitely. Well, first of all, let me, I think I completely agree with the point you made about including the communities, because actually at the end of the day, each one of us might be a specialist in a field or two, but then for the rest of the fields is just part of the community. And so it's to our benefit as individuals that we be included even in things that we're not specialists in. But back to your question, I think definitely, and in Agia is an excellent example of that. So I've been a member in Agia for 5 years, and then since a year ago, I've been an alumni. And so for all these years, one of the great highlights was this ability to work with other scientists and speak with other scientists. And just like today, I'm learning a lot from you and from your ideas and from how you conduct things in your fields. And in many cases, that gives me ideas that I maybe can take to my own field and try to apply there, or ideas that we bring to somewhere in the middle and discuss together. And so definitely that's been very useful, and really expanding the horizons. And sometimes there are many topics where one gets a question, and then it's very nice to be able to find a friend or colleague to discuss the topic with and see what are their views from their fields. And I would like to ask you about something that I read in your biography on the Agia website, and kind of your involvement with what's called the frugal innovation. Which sounds to me like a great idea. Sounds to me like not just trying to find new things, but trying to find new things that work for without exhausting resources. And this could be useful for many countries in the world. So I was wondering if you can elaborate on that.
Sure. Yes, of course, Ahmed. That's actually sort of related to what we've just been discussing, because frugal innovation it's not complicated, the concept. It's actually quite simple. The idea is that, an innovation is something that's new. We're looking to improve something, to change something with a positive effect. That can be anything. It can be the way we are teaching. It can be something that actually, if it's a proper innovation in quotation marks, that lands on the market, so something, a product or a service. But we can take the term much broader. It's really about changing in a positive manner. And the adjective frugal is a word that comes actually from Latin originally and actually means moderate. So you're proving something in a way that is moderate, in the sense that you're really just focusing on what is needed. So usually you have one element you want to improve. So you're not just about to create the next amazing car, but you're looking for a new way of mobility. And usually with all the elements that are given. So you're looking at the situation that is in front of you. And that's why I think your question is fantastic, because yes, in many countries, the situation of, let's say the things, the resources you can work with are limited. And with frugality, or with a frugal way of approaching change, you really say, okay, this is what I have. These are the options I can do. And now let me improve one thing, one quality. I'm not focusing on many. There's one aim I'm following. And I'm just improving or changing something or creating something that is really just meant to solve this particular problem. And that's a frugal innovation. So it's not about creating needs. It's not about, changing the market as a whole, although it can be. It is really about focusing on one problem and solving it with everything I have in front of me. That's the idea of frugal innovation. And with the research you're referring to, we've been looking at this because it's a type of innovation that actually comes from a grassroots innovation. So it comes from countries or regions in the world that, as I've said, are usually economically weak or don't have so many resources. So the idea has become very, very strong in India, for instance, and has now spread to other parts of the world. And the question is, where, to whom can it be beneficial, and who would be interested in innovations like frugal innovation? And we found even for Germany, there is a need, or there is a desire is maybe too strong, but people are looking for frugal innovations as well. And this is a country where, we are known for sometimes over-technologizing, for producing complex solutions, for especially technological solutions. But sometimes they are too complex, and sometimes they're not actually what the people need. And sometimes they are looking for simpler solutions. So frugal innovation is not just something for regions that are in a, let's say, situation of scarcity, but it is also something for countries where people are really turning away sometimes from complexity towards simpler solutions. That's what the study has found we've been looking at. Ahmed, have you been in contact with these kinds of innovations or these kinds of changes? Does that idea of looking for one solution, just a particular solution to solve just one problem, is that something relevant in your mathematical work you're doing? Does that ring a bell, or does the complexity you're working with not allow for such an approach?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's generally speaking, usually improvement happens one step at a time. So I can definitely relate with that concept on the professional level. But also, I guess your answer was very beneficial in the sense that this concept is really now needed worldwide because of, for example, let's say an example that just comes to mind is this idea of finding effective and inexpensive tests for COVID. And so, yes, there might be some tests that are costly. And in this case, not even, even in a rich country, it cannot be afforded for many people many times. But if we are able to find, by we, I mean the scientific community, in particular, the biologists and virologists and so on, if they're able to find inexpensive ways, then this will benefit everyone globally. And I think that's maybe another positive point that came out of the current crisis. I mean, of course, there are many negatives and there are many tragic things that happened, but life goes on and we have to look for the positives sometimes. And that's the global interconnectivity that people are feeling more. In my case, for example, I felt that the fact that this virus was not just affecting my country, but it was affecting everyone. And so this gave us a chance to see different approaches from different countries to it. There are some countries that started with the lockdown early on. There are some that waited. There are some that did extensive testing, some that did it only for people who showed symptoms. And at the end of the day, by this flow of information, I think people were able to reach a best possible model. We didn't have to repeat each other's mistakes. This was one aspect. There is another aspect maybe, which is perhaps a little bit more scientific, a little bit more abstract, is that sometimes different countries tried more or less identical approaches and it worked one way for some and not the other, not the same way for the others. And that's something that, people have to be aware that it's not just one action that will affect things, but you have to be aware of the other parameters around it and be more scientific about it. But I guess this was the point that I wanted to discuss is how do you feel about this global connection that this COVID brought to us?
Yes, for all of us, or all of those who have the ability to access, let's say, any kind of digital tool that allows us to connect in a digital way to each other, we are very privileged in the sense that we are able to reach out and to connect with people suddenly much more easily, and it's also much much more normal to reach out to people across the globe suddenly. So it's brought us really more together. I absolutely agree with you. Now, I have to admit, I'm not sure, I'm sometimes in my own bubble. I don't know how it is for you. Even though I'm doing a lot of work with different groups of society, I still sometimes realize that I'm, as a scientist, as a teacher, but also as a researcher, we're sometimes in our own world. And as academics, we are already sort of well connected. And COVID has just made this more stronger. So I feel this interconnectedness very, very strongly, but I'm actually not sure whether this applies to all, areas of the world. And I would assume it's not the case. And it would be actually a wonderful research question to find out who made it stronger in a sense that they feel more connected to other parts of the world that are affected in the same way, although they're living in a completely different geographical context. That's, as you said, either applying different ways of tackling the crisis or where the effects of certain measures to tackle the crisis are different because we have a different geographical context. So I'm not sure I can fully answer your question, because I do know that in my case and the people I'm mostly surrounded with, this interconnectedness has become stronger. But I would wonder whether this is the same for all, especially for those who either do not have as much access to digital tools, who have difficulty making use of this for whatever, personal, let's say, community reasons this might be. What do you think about this personally, and maybe with what you've been experiencing regarding the interconnectedness? or the feeling of being more connected?
You made some excellent points. And from my point of view, I agree with you that not everybody will have the tools and the connectedness and so on. But I think it's enough in each society to make informed discussions. You know, even within, let's say, social circles, different social circles where people are discussing whether it's... because if you remember at the beginning, especially when people started doing the lockdowns, there was this idea of the economic impact of a lockdown. And then there was this discussion about, well, but if the number of cases rises too much and we ended up having tragic losses, then this will have an even bigger economic impact on the long term. And within these discussions, it is useful for some people, at least. Maybe not everybody will read everything. Certainly, I don't read everything. But at least I can bring an example, let's say, and say, well, you can look at this country or that country. They did the lockdown right away. These waited and look at where they are now. And then, you know, when you're discussing with people, and hopefully this will make its way to decision makers and so on, then they can have a more informed decision and find what's right for their parameters and what's right for their population. And maybe that brings us back to one other aspect of the scientific method, if you may, which is we talked about how the current effects went, you know, with people trying to learn new things and certain scientists being given a voice to teach us about their fields. We talked about how we learned from history. But I think another aspect is what are the projections for the future? So it will be probably informed both by history and by current research. But I think also another discussion that is particularly relevant for a group like AGIA, which is multidisciplinary and has an interest in society, the question of how are we going to deal after COVID-19? What are the things that we will need to change? What are the things that will change by themselves? For example, online teaching, is it here to stay? Online working and so on. Again, the science spending, we discussed that. So what is your take on that? What are some of the things that you think will be visible changes that were caused by COVID?
So thank you, Ahmed, for this very important question. I will answer it by looking at the effects of on the methods as a scientist, as well as the way we teach, as you've said. So I do think, as we've said, and as we've started to discuss in the very beginning, I do think methodologically speaking, so that means the mix of methods and tools we are using in order to approach our questions, we will hopefully, first of all, of course, excel or improve the ones we are using, like in your case, for instance, mathematical modeling, and I'll ask you a question about this in a second. So, well, for me, doing qualitative work with communities, involving focus groups, expert groups, having group discussions and analyzing the dynamics and the answers we are receiving in a more qualitative way. At the same time, I do think bringing these different methods together and creating languages that help us to understand each other better, because as academics, we tend to speak languages that are rooted in our disciplines for various reasons. But to develop a language that allows us to bridge between the sciences, but also to bridge our communication to society, that should and will change. I'm pretty sure. And I'm also sure that a trend that has already emerged, and now I'm not sure about Egypt so much, but we see it in Europe very strongly, a trend that is emerging to work really more strongly with society and for society in order to get away from this image of a scientific ivory tower, but rather to do science for the people, I think this will even become more stronger. And with respect to teaching, this is a very open question. I do think online teaching and online workshops will become more important. At the same time, I do hope that they will not fully replace face-to-face lessons and teaching, because there is a benefit to both. Yes, for some cases or in ways, it's more beneficial to have an online concept instead of flying somewhere and, you know, giving a talk for, I don't know, 4 hours in a classroom that's hundreds of kilometers away from us. And yet, and also for the students, I have to say, you know, who have to sometimes come from remote places to listen to a seminar, for them it's also sometimes harder to be in a place than to actually have the online access. And yet, when we teach, it's not only about the knowledge. It's often about empowering people, about creating group dynamics, about inspiring students. And that is a challenge via an online tool. Maybe we can handle it. Maybe we will, most probably, will develop some solutions to do this. But this other aspect of teaching is harder through a digital tool than it is when we have the students in front of us and when we can work with them. That's my personal opinion. So I expect a mix at some point, you know, taking ideally like the benefits of both worlds in quotation marks. So the benefits of online teaching combined with where we really needed face-to-face classroom teaching. Now, what's your take on this? What do you think? How is it going to change the way you do science as a mathematician in Egypt, but also with Agia and with the rest of the world? And how is it affecting your teaching, Ahmed?
Well, I guess, I completely agree with how each of them has its own benefits, like the online and the in-person. And I think, you know, if my voice would be for something of what's being called the blended approach, so where maybe instead of having to meet face to face for maybe 4 hours or 6 hours, then maybe we can have like 3 online and 3 in person, and this way people don't have to commute as much, don't have to interact as much, but there is still that element of personal interaction, because when one is meeting with a person face to face, there is so much going on other than the transmission of the knowledge. This whole demeanor, this whole approach that I don't see how it's going to be replaced by the digital means. I think, you know, the digital means will be beneficial to a point, but then after that, it's beneficial to be like in the full presence of the person. So that's at least my hope, how things proceed. The same with scientific meetings, scientific collaborations, and so on. I mean, I think this, I don't know how long this feature has been there, but, you know, when everybody started using the different softwares, it became very relevant to this screen sharing. And for me, it was very useful, like when I have a meeting with a collaborator or with a student, and then we can open the exact page where we want to discuss and highlight the lines that we want to discuss. So this is, you know, this covers a lot of the positive aspects of being close to each other.
Yes, I agree, Ahmed. And maybe as a last question, I would like to ask you, if you had one wish free, something you could ask for, what would it be with respect to COVID-19? As a researcher and as a teacher, as somebody who's working deeply internationally, but who's also very, very, very excellent in his own discipline, what would that one wish, that one thing you would ask for, what would it be?
Well, I guess the easy answer would be for it to just completely go away and disappear, but I don't think you wanted something that simple. So let me try for something a little bit more elaborate, because, you know, in some sense, that's not a realistic wish. But realistically speaking, I think we will hope that we learned all the lessons that we can learn from it, in the sense that, you know, the place of research and researcher in society can be reestablished, and you know, people really recognizing that this is not a luxury, this is something that's important for all of us. And the researchers themselves, they learn how to, you know, approach the crises and learning in the most collaborative and open manner, so that, you know, the ideas that you mentioned perhaps about involving the society and having the society's feedback and making them really recognize the importance of the work. And, you know, one important thing for that is that for the society to have an input and a discussion. Maybe, you know, not everything that's requested can be achieved or is beneficial, but this should come through a discussion. So I guess that would be, I guess I have two answers. One of them is the fairy tale answer, which is for it to just completely go away. And the other one is the more realistic one, is for us to learn the lessons as societies and as individuals, and maybe I would even add as, you know, global citizens in a sense, because I guess the other thing is that, you know, when this COVID-19 came, a lot of the things that we had taken for granted, certain trips, going to conferences, maybe certain things in our daily lives, were suddenly taken away from us, and we realized that we would really miss them. And We have to keep in mind that there are certain other parts of the society or of the planet where some people didn't have these privileges in the first place, never. And so maybe it's a good idea to also have more compassion and try to work for the well-being of all of our fellow humans. And now let me ask you the same question. What would be your wish?
Oh, Ahmed, you've basically almost given my answer. I loved your point about global citizens and compassion, because if I would like us to take something away, it's really, if that's not already happening, but maybe to change the identity, our identity, if the way we see our role in society, but also the way we are seen in society. So I would love that, let's say, the trust in science and the role of science and education is actually being strengthened. But yes, of course, that can only happen if we are, as researchers, also more compassionate, if we are listening more deeply to what is needed, and if we're developing tools to listen to each other, but also, as we said, to the people whom we're actually doing the work for. So I think compassion and an increase of impact would be, as you said, would also be my wish. Yes. Thank you, Ahmed.
Thank you very much, Luisa. It's been a true pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you too, Ahmed. And I've been really enjoying this conversation. I would love to continue or to maybe do it another time with a slightly different aspect as well. And of course, at some point, I would also like to know where you would have liked to go away. And hopefully, you know, we can travel again at some point and go somewhere to recharge our batteries, because that as well is important, you know, in these times of crisis, to find a space to really be in ourselves and to digest the stress that it's bringing in order to bring the positive out. So thank you very much, Ahmed. I've really enjoyed this. Take good care and speak to you very soon.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the podcast Agia Goes Viral. You can find all of the podcast episodes on our website, agia.info. That's AGYA.info. Until next time, please stay healthy and safe.